From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand. Created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
Every day, it seems, we get new reports on just how badly post-war Iraq was planned and is being managed. Rajiv Chandrasekharan, who served as the Baghdad bureau chief for the Washington Post for the first year of the war, details how Beltway politics may have squandered an opportunity in Iraq in his new book, Imperial Life in the Imperial City. He also reveals what life is really like inside the heavily fortified green zone with its towering palms, swimming pools, six bars, disco, and a dining hall. The book is published by Knopf, and it is my pleasure to welcome Mr. Chandrasekharan to my show today. Hello.
Good afternoon. Good to be here.
How large is the Green Zone, and where is it located within Baghdad?
The Green Zone is smack dab right in the middle of Baghdad, and it's 7 square miles. It was actually built up by Saddam Hussein years ago as sort of the area to surround his Republican palace.
So it's like the Kremlin or the Forbidden City?
Exactly. And, you know, he walled it off, and it was, you know, home to the seat of government and then palaces for his children and offices for ministers and, you know, villas for his bodyguards and cronies. And when the Americans showed up in April 2003, this became the ideal place to set up shop because it was self-contained and it had, walls and a few entrances.
But I would imagine somebody might have noticed that it also would have a negative symbolism.
Certainly. And there were some civilians in that initial wave of American reconstruction personnel who voiced concern about this, who said, perhaps we should be in a hotel, perhaps we should be someplace else. And the military, particularly the people entrusted with what they called force protection, overrode them and said, well, this is the safest place. And, you know, because it has this nice big setback, because Saddam designs it that way, it'll be perfect for us.
But it's been changed a lot since Saddam.
Oh, most certainly. It's been Americanized, shall we say. The walls are bigger. There's barbed wire. There are more guard posts. So it's far more fortified than it ever was in his day. But on the inside, it's turned into a little America. You mentioned, as I write in the book, there were bars set up, six or seven of them. There was at least one of them a disco. It became
chapels.
There was
chapels
and Bible study classes and salsa dancing classes and places. There were gymnasiums. There were not one but two Chinese restaurants. There was a Green Zone cafe. It was a little city. It was the ultimate. It was the ultimate walled-off, gated community.
And Halliburton was brought in to construct this thing and then run it?
Yes, and much of the services were provided by Halliburton. Halliburton brought in hundreds of brand-new Chevy Suburbans, so all the occupants drove around in these brand-new, sparkly, clean SUVs. And meanwhile, on the outside, beyond the walls, Baghdad's traffic was chaotic. There were no traffic police on duty. There were no traffic lights that were working. But inside, it was, as I write in the book, the sort of calm sterility of an American subdivision prevailed. People drove around at 35 miles an hour. Nobody sped. Halliburton posted speed limit signs there. And, you know, beyond the traffic and the cars, Halliburton ran a dry cleaning service that would get the sweat stains out of your clothes in 2 days. And Halliburton set up a sports bar at the Al Rashid Hotel. They even imported a foosball table for people to play around in.
So people could drive around the 7 square mile area and never even bother to leave. They could just live in this little enclave.
For many of them, all they needed was their food, recreation, their offices, swimming pools, fitness centers. So there were a lot of people who, you know, if they didn't have to leave for a meeting, would stay in there. I met a young man, incidentally, from my own hometown in Northern California, who'd been there for 3 months and had left once.
Did they ever meet Iraqis there?
A few. The only Iraqis allowed into the Green Zone were Iraqis who could prove they lived there from before the war. And that would mean that they were sort of very low-level personnel who had worked for the government. Or they were people who worked for the American Occupation Authority as translators or drivers or janitors. But a lot of those people knew that they had it really good with their jobs in the Green Zone. So they never really confronted the Americans with the grim truth of what was outside. They didn't want to risk, they knew what life was like in the old days. They didn't quite understand how things were shaping up with the Americans in the new days. So they didn't want to be seen as too outspoken. So they just sort of nodded along in assent. It was rare for the Americans inside the Green Zone to hear anything really critical about what they were doing to the country.
My guest is Rajiv Chandrasekaran, an assistant managing editor of the Washington Post. He has served in the Post as bureau chief in Baghdad, Cairo, and Southeast Asia, and as a correspondent covering the war in Afghanistan. And he's written a book called Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone, which is published by Knopf. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. There's quite a bit in your book about the food that's served in the Green Zone. Can you describe some of the meals that are typically offered and explain why pork seems to be the meat of choice?
Sure. You know, to me, the food that was served there was emblematic of the tone deafness displayed by the American Occupation Administration.
Because pork is not allowed in the Muslim diet.
It's incredibly offensive. And it wasn't just a one-off thing. Almost every day when you went to that buffet, you'd find some pork product. Pork bacon for breakfast, hot dogs for lunch, pork chops for dinner, bacon cheeseburgers, bacon grilled cheese sandwiches. It was like Halliburton had gotten some marvelous discount on a shipload of pork and had brought it into Iraq. Now, the thing here is that there were Iraqis who ate at that dining hall, Iraqi Muslims, and they were incredibly offended by this. And in fact, some of them raised this with their superiors, who raised it with people at Halliburton. But the bottom line was Iraqi sensitivities, cultural sensitivity, was pushed aside in the name of the morale of the Americans. It was all about serving them high-calorie, high-fat comfort food, often with a southern flavor.
Do you think that it also might have been a way of making distinctions between us and them?
Well, I don't
think... You know, we do this, and we're not like them.
I don't think they even put that much thought in it. I think it was simply, we like this. It's tasty to us. This is what we eat at home. So, hey, this is our turf. This is our palace at this moment. We're the occupation power. So we're gonna serve what we like to eat.
And the man who was running this for Halliburton was a guy named Michael Cole, who was in his early 20s. How does a guy like that wind up with such an important position? Or is it an important position?
Well, he wasn't running the whole thing. He was one of their sort of customer service managers, but he was sort of the public face of all of this.
He was running dining services,
yeah,
wasn't he?
This is emblematic of the entire occupation administration, where you got a lot of young people without a lot of specific subject matter expertise brought out to do tasks. And in fact, the fact that running a dining hall and doing some of this customer service stuff, that was sort of the least of the problems. You wound up with young people without a whole lot of experience in their specific fields being asked to do things like reopening the stock exchange or managing elements of Iraq's $13 billion budget. And they were brought out there largely because they were seen as loyal Republicans. These were kids who had worked on Capitol Hill in Republican offices, who had applied for jobs at conservative think tanks, who worked for other parts of the Bush administration, various cabinet agencies. And they were brought out there because of their political loyalty, not because they knew anything about post-conflict reconstruction or had any prior expertise in the Middle East.
And you report that in this book, and that has led the House Democratic Whip, Steny H. Hoyer of Maryland, and Representative Henry A. Waxman of California, the ranking Democrat on the House Government Reform Committee, to send a letter last week to the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, asking him for an investigation into the coalition provision authority's hiring practices.
The book has really drawn a lot of attention up on Capitol Hill, particularly among Democratic members of Congress who have been very surprised by the degree to which the occupation effort was politicized. I think there was a belief that we were going to send the best and the brightest to do this job, and what I write about is that we sent the loyal and the willing instead. And that is just one – what you mentioned there, that request, that investigation is just one of three developments. Harry Reid, the Senate Minority Leader, has also asked Secretary Rumsfeld for an investigation into the Coalition Provisional Authority. And I've also heard that members of Congress are asking the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, to mount its own investigation. This would be a congressional investigation into the CPA.
And one of the things that bothered them a lot was that a CPA staffer was quoted as saying to – was it you over lunch? I'm not here for the Iraqis. I'm here for George Bush.
Yeah.
Now, were they totally oblivious to the fact that you were working for the Washington Post and you might actually write that down and report it?
You know, I think that they were just so taken in those heady days after the liberation of Baghdad that they felt that, you know, they could get away with saying this stuff. They were so convinced that Iraq would be a success story, that they were going to build this model Jeffersonian democracy with a free market right there in the heart of the Middle East, and it would have such a transformative impact. They believed in the rhetoric. So I think they felt that saying this sort of thing was just fine because it would show that the, you know, at the end of the day, the president's vision was right and they were going to be seen as heroes. So it certainly they wouldn't say it today, but it was a completely different environment back then.
But getting back to the food, it seems to me if you're that insulated, then how can you build a Jeffersonian democracy? I mean, these are the people who are not eating any Iraqi cuisine, so they have no sense of what the people are involved in. They have Indians and Pakistanis preparing the food for them, which is imported from outside. And Indians and Pakistanis also are prohibited from eating pork, aren't they?
At least many of the Pakistani Muslims, of course.
And many Indians don't eat any meat.
Yep.
Then you have alcoholic beverages being, because they have all these bars, being made available in the green zone. Now, I know there was some alcohol available in Saddam's days, but Islam prohibits yep. the drinking of alcoholic beverages. So how can they hope to create a Jeffersonian democracy if they have no idea of the people who would be practicing this Jeffersonian democracy?
Look, to you and me, this sounds absurd. I'm sure to many of your listeners it sounds absurd. But remember, a lot of the people who went out there didn't understand Iraq. I mean, as I also write in this book, fully half of the people who went out there for the occupation effort had to apply for their first passport to go there. These weren't people who had traveled in the Middle East. They didn't have any connection to the country. And so it was sort of natural for them to just revert back to their American ways of doing things. And the idea that you need to be consultative, that you need to bring the Iraqis on board in decision-making. Well, some people did. I don't mean to sort of tar everybody as ignorant. There were certainly some very smart, progressive-thinking people who were out there as part of that effort. But there were also other people who just didn't get it, who thought that what Iraq needed to get back up on its feet were a bunch of smart Americans sitting in nicely air-conditioned conference rooms in the palace, diagramming the new structure, let's say, of the school system on a whiteboard, and that they would simply have to write it and promulgate an edict, and that would be all it would take. Failing to understand that in a developing society like Iraq, in a strife-torn nation like that, that it's not the law that you promulgate, it's not the edict that you write, it's actually getting buy-in among local people, it's providing resources, and it's making that stuff happen at a ground level. That development has to be organic, it has to be bottom-up. Instead, the Americans came and thought that they could impose top-down solutions.
And they ate in dining rooms that had large murals of 9/11. So they were convinced that they were partly fighting the terrorists who were responsible for 9/11?
Yes. There were a number of people out there who thought that there was a connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. And the mural is a great piece of evidence to support that there, you know, they saw this link that was alleged by senior members of the Bush administration. You know, again, it sounds a little silly to be, you know, when we sit here today to say that. But back then, they were convinced that there was a nexus between Saddam Hussein and international terrorism.
My guess is Rajiv Chandrasekharan, whose book Imperial Life in the Emerald City Inside Iraq's Green Zone is published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Rajiv Chandrasekharan, who has written a book called Imperial Life in the Emerald City Inside Iraq's Green Zone. Mr. Chandrasekharan is assistant managing editor of the Washington Post and served as the Post bureau chief in Baghdad in the first year after?
First 18 months after the fall of Saddam Hussein's
government.
So
how soon after the fall were you there in the Green Zone? And was the Green Zone pretty much the place to be from the start?
I entered the Green Zone for the first time, or what would become the Green Zone, the first time, 2 days after that statue of Saddam Hussein was felled in Ferdows Square. It was one of the first reporting trips I made in Baghdad, and I actually walked all the way from that front gate, the Assassin's Gate, all the way down to the palace, past a handful of bold looters, and saw some corpses of Republican Guard soldiers, and got into the palace and met a young lieutenant who gave me a tour and, in fact, took me out back to show me Uday Hussein's menagerie. We saw cheetahs and a brown bear. And what was really telling at that point was that the American soldiers who were in the palace, in this 258-room marbled-walled palace, were just in one wing. They had kept themselves to a few rooms because they felt they weren't going to be there to occupy that country very long. They would turn this over to the Iraqis. It wasn't until a few weeks later, when larger waves of American civilians descended on the place, that they decided, this is the ideal place to put up our flag.
Where were you living?
I was living outside the Green Zone in a place that the Denizens of the Emerald City used to call the Red Zone. It was real Iraq. It was Baghdad. I was first in a hotel, and then we at the Washington Post rented a house, and we had that for a while until we were threatened and forced to move around. We've had a few residences, but they've all been outside. I had the unique ability, though, to go back and forth. As an American journalist, as an American citizen, with my passport and my Washington Post press card, I could cross that cellular membrane of the Green Zone all the time. So I was able to see what life was like on the outside and what life was like on the inside.
Since you don't look like what I think most Iraqis would assume an American looks like.
A little darker skin.
A little darker skin. Did that help at all?
It certainly did in terms of traveling around Iraq. But remember, in those first few weeks and months after Saddam was overthrown, I told everybody I was an American. I was from the Washington Post. And I was often embraced. People, you know, invited me into their homes. In fact, I joked that the greatest danger I felt in those first few weeks was being offered a lunch with food of some unknown provenance. You know, where's this meat from? But, you know, nobody was out to do any harm to me. I could travel out to Ramadi in the west, down south to Basra. So long as I had a bottle of water and gas in the tank, it was no problem. But then, you know, that great window of opportunity, the political capital that we had as liberators of the Iraqi people, I just witnessed firsthand how we, with decision after decision, just squandered it away. You know, there was the de-Ba'athification order. There was disbanding the army. There was going to the United Nations here in New York and saying, we wish to be enshrined with Security Council resolution as the occupying power there. And then told the Iraqis that we're going to be your occupiers. And by the way, we're not going to tell you how long we're going to be here. We're going to be here indefinitely until we decide you're ready for sovereignty again. And almost overnight, we went from beloved liberators to despised occupiers.
How responsible was Paul Bremer for all of this? Because he was the man who debathified the country and debathified the army. Was he doing it, do you think, on his own, or was he just simply following the orders of people in Washington?
As I write in the book, you know, a lot of this was his own doing. You know, he came in with a relatively long leash. The feeling was that the first American administrator there, General Jay Garner, wasn't quite up to the task. And Bremer was going to be the take charge guy who was going to literally march onto the field in a chaotic field without a real playbook. And he was going to call the plays on the field. So the White House gave him really room to run. The problem was that Bremer was not, in my view, consultative enough. He didn't listen enough to what the Iraqis wanted or needed, and he imposed a lot of solutions that were cooked up in the Emerald City with a small handful of advisors that didn't really go down very well among the Iraqi people. And I detail a number of them in the book, and it goes beyond simply debathification and dissolving the army. It was the way he created his governing council. It was the other policies that people working for him put into place. You know, it's a country with 40% unemployment, and what do they think that they need to get the economy back up on its feet? His economic czar, one of his first initiatives, was to push through a flat tax. I mean,
this is Jim O'Byrne?
No, this is a guy named Peter McPherson, his economic czar, who came in and said, you know, let's put a flat tax in. Let's aggressively privatize government-run businesses. Now,
so Jack Kemp suddenly was the philosophical basis for something in Iraq?
It turned into this great terrarium for neoconservative policies.
Then there is this guy, Jim O'Byrne, a 24-year-old kid who was put in charge of the finance ministry.
Couple of little things to tweak around. Jim O'Byrne was a guy in the Pentagon who was the gatekeeper. There's a guy named Jay Hallin who was in charge of the stock market. But Jim O'Byrne is an interesting guy that you mention him to talk about. He is the husband of a very prominent conservative commentator, Kate O'Byrne, who appears regularly on Fox and other networks. Jim holds a kind of an obscure job. He is the White House liaison to the Pentagon, and he runs this office that vets political appointees within the Pentagon. And so when the occupation administration was set up in Baghdad, there was a need to staff it with people. And so the job of staffing it, in part, fell to O'Byrne and his office. And instead of seeking out the best and the brightest, instead of looking for people with specific skills across the United States, regardless of whether they worked in government or in the private sector, regardless of party affiliation, O'Byrne's office established certain criteria for people going out there. And what seemed most important to them was political loyalty. So people were sought out and recruited by him who were good, loyal Republicans, and others were queried, did you vote for George W. Bush in 2000? Are you a member of the Republican Party? Two people have even told me they were asked what their views on Roe versus Wade were. Another young man said he was subjected to a 10-minute speech before going out to Baghdad, which I detail in the book, where he was subjected to statements supporting capital punishment, opposing abortion. And the guy didn't agree with what was being said, but he sort of nodded his head in assent, and he told me that he felt pressure to agree if he wanted to go out to Baghdad. I mean, what does this have to do with reconstructing Iraq?
Well, the British didn't demand any political fealty of that sort, but we had a man on our show, Rory Stewart, who, with no experience, was put in charge of a province by the British part of this occupation. So I guess a lot of people who had no experience were put in charge to run a country that is a rather sophisticated country and that needed an awful lot of sophisticated people in charge.
But at least Rory had, you know, walked across Afghanistan. He had served as a diplomat in Indonesia. Actually, we were both in Indonesia at the same time some years ago. He knew a little something about the Muslim world. Even though he was a young man, he came with some skills. He was eminently more qualified than most of the young Americans who were sent and give to Baghdad to work in the Green Zone and given even more important jobs. I mean, Rory was given authority over a small province in southeastern Iraq. I mean, they were people with a tenth of his expertise, given jobs that were 10 times more important.
Running the healthcare system, for example.
Healthcare. I mean, healthcare is a great example. I mean, before the war, the U.S. Agency for International Development sent a guy to Kuwait to be ready to go into Baghdad named Skip Buerkle. And Skip Buerkle is a physician. He holds a master's in public health. He's a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. He works at USAID. He has 4 postgraduate degrees, 2 Bronze Stars, and served in Kosovo, Haiti, northern Iraq after the first Gulf War. A colleague at USAID calls him the single most talented public health professional working for the U.S. government who works in post-conflict zones. 2 weeks into it, he was yanked. He got an email from a senior official at USAID saying the White House wanted a quote-unquote loyalist in the job. I write in the book, Buerkle had a wall full of degrees, but he didn't have a picture with the president. Who was sent over in his place? A guy by the name of Jim Haviman. Jim Haviman is not a physician. He was the director of community health for the state of Michigan. But Michigan's Republican governor, John Engler, recommended him to Paul Wolfowitz, the deputy secretary of defense, who got this guy out to Baghdad. Mr. Haviman's experience overseas was primarily as a director of a evangelical Christian aid agency. And prior to his stint in government, he had run a large adoption agency in Michigan that urged pregnant women not to have abortions. And when Haviman came out there, he came with his own set of priorities. Instead of devoting lots of resources to fixing Iraq's emergency rooms, you can make an argument that because you have so many people getting killed by insurgent attacks or getting wounded, that you want to put a lot of resources toward that. He instead devoted resources to things like rewriting the list of medicines Iraq imports. Why? Because rewriting a prescription formulary was something he had done in Michigan, and he had saved millions of dollars for the state of Michigan, so he figured, well, it worked for me over there. Why don't I try to implement it over here in Iraq?
Now, then there's the matter of former New York City Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik. He got the job of going to Iraq in 2003 and to restore law and order. He's since been pleaded guilty to 2 misdemeanor charges for accepting gifts from a mob-tied contractor while he was the city's correction commissioner. So I guess we shouldn't have expected much. But what did he actually do in Iraq?
I detail some fascinating Bernie Kerik stories in this book. You know, go back to right after the war. The U.S. Justice Department sent an assessment team to figure out what Iraq needed in terms of resources to get its police force back up and in gear. And these independent experts from the Justice Department concluded Iraq needed 6,600 foreign police advisors. What did the White House do? It dispatched one guy, Bernie Kerik. And Bernie came out there with a mission to highlight the positive. So as soon as he got into Baghdad, he did a slew of TV interviews, went on the Today Show and other places to say, hey, it's not as bad as you think it is. Things are getting better here. He then, you know, went on a handful of sort of very showy raids and other kind of police operations in an effort to, again, drum up some good TV coverage. And so he would be out at night sort of doing these things and then come back in and show up at Bremer's morning staff meeting, crack a few jokes, read a few crime stats. But then during the day, when the really important job of training the Iraqi police and vetting the police was to happen, and we can agree now that training the police is one of the most important things we have to do. It's a key prerequisite to getting our troops back home. When that job was to happen during the day, Bernie Kerik was back in his trailer resting because he'd been working all night. And this was what was told to me by a number of people who worked with him. And they were sort of beside themselves. And people wanted to blow the whistle on him, but he was seen as sort of untouchable. He was the police commissioner in New York during 9/11. So nobody could say a word about him. And so meanwhile, these people working for him were growing increasingly frustrated because they needed resources to train the police, and they weren't getting it.
Well, 3.5 months after he arrived, 105 days, he abruptly left Baghdad on a CIA flight. So what happened then?
Well, you know, it's hard to exactly know why he left. He never told any of the people why he was leaving. As I recount in the book, he just showed up one day at a meeting of police chiefs and stood up and said, farewell. And he left that afternoon.
Now, the Bush administration insists that we stay the course in Iraq. In your estimation, what would that mean at this point?
Well, I think we have to be realistic about what does staying the course mean. We're not going to, in my view, anytime soon be able to create a peaceful, secular, stable democracy with a functioning free market, the sort of country that the president and Ambassador Bremer had pledged to create way back in 2003. But I also believe that if we were just to pull out right now, the country would slip even further into chaos, that the civil strife that we see today with dozens of people getting killed, those death tolls would probably go into the hundreds. And would we feel comfortable seeing that kind of bloodbath in the country? But we're not there to sort of bring about the kind of Iraq that we hoped to create way back when.
And as a commission just reported, it's likely that our occupation is actually leading to the creation of more terrorists. So perhaps we have to rethink the way we're going to do what you're suggesting.
I think so. And I think that we have to ensure that our continued presence there is done in such a way that we're not further angering Iraqis.
Rajiv Chandrasekharan will be speaking and signing books tomorrow at 7 o'clock at the Malika restaurant.
Actually, it's tonight.
It's tonight. Okay.
Yes.
It's 210 West 43rd Street. On October 5th at 6:30, he'll be participating in a panel on war reporting at the CUNY Graduate Center. For more details on these things, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. The book, Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone, is published by Knopf. On tomorrow's show, Daniel Goleman explains how all social interactions shape our brains and bodies, and then a tube and throat singer performing rock and roll classics. A new film explores a summer camp that teaches kids to take back America for Christ. Plus, physicist Lee Smolin argues that string theory is a flawed failure. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Melissa Egan with Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neshek. We had help today from Paula Crossfield, Brian Levinson, and Angie Dickinson. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.